she went on drowsily. I learned to hate them well before I knew about the lost tribe. Forgive me. She wasn't sure whether that last was for her or for Karim. Then Salsana slept, leaving Chayda to listen to the snap of the fire and the occasional wail from Karim in the distance. Chapter 14. Chayda woke to the sounds of shushing. She'd been unable to sleep long into the night, worrying over Salsana's wounds, worrying over whether she'd be able to stop Karim from attacking her again. She'd managed to fall asleep only after the moons had set. The shushing sounds came closer, and she realized dully that they were footsteps. Fearful that Anur had found her, she rolled over to find an old man with six young male warriors behind him, each with swords at their sides, bucklers hanging from their belts, and bows across their backs. Chayda stood immediately, but left River's daughter where it lay, half hidden by her blanket. A few hundred paces beyond the men were a dozen ships, with women, men, and children disembarking, unloading tents and crates. In the distance, the razed teeth of the dark Toloran mountains were framed by a pale honey sky. Gods, how could I have slept through all this? To her wakeful ears, they were loud and raucous, while only moments ago they had been a muted part of her dreams. The old man's eyes glittered in the morning sun.
Look at the lost doves we found.
Smiling as he was, he looked like a desert lynx who'd stumbled upon a succulent scorpion. He had a long grey beard with twin streaks of black running through it. He wore simple desert garb, a sandy thawb with yellow embroidery, a wide belt made of sea-green silk, a kenshar and a shamshir with simple leather sheaths. He looked like many who lived in the Shangazi and travelled ceaselessly along her hidden paths, but Chayda knew this was Ishak Kirhan Ava, the leader of the Moonless Host. Chayda's own grandfather. She recognized him from his visit to her mother Aya in Sharakai. He had the same intense expression, the sharp features, the golden rings in his nose and the blue tattoos around his eyes and cheeks and chin. And there was the vicious scar that ran down his neck, lost beneath the collar of his thawb. She'd seen it. She'd asked him about it long ago, and remembered the wicked gleam in his eyes as he had opened his thawb and showed it to her.
You think you could live after getting cut like this?
He said it with pride, but it had scared her witless. She'd shaken her head, too terrified to say a word.
No, I don't think so either,
he replied, thankfully covering up the scar.
So be careful, little one. Always be careful.
Aya had walked in a moment later, a disgusted look on her face. At the time, Chayda thought her mother was simply protecting her, but through the eyes of adulthood, Chayda could see it wasn't true at all. Or at least wasn't the whole truth. She had taken great pains to hide her own past from Chayda. She had not wanted Chayda to know that the man was her grandfather. Had Ishak wanted to hide the truth as well? She wasn't sure. But if so, why? Ishak's gaze moved to Salsana, who lay on the opposite side of the cold fire pit. Her eyes were barely open. With great effort, she pulled herself up into a sitting position.
You're early.
Arms folded across his chest, he jutted his chin toward Chayda.
I suppose I shouldn't be surprised Leora sent you to fetch her.
Salsana squinted at the rising sun, took in the warriors fanning out behind Ishak, then met Ishak's disappointed eyes.
Is that why you came running to meet her? Watch your tongue, Ishak said with anger. You have much to answer for.
Chayda didn't understand everything, but she knew enough to know that Leora had somehow intercepted Beryl's plea for help and that she had sent Salsana there before Ishak could find out about it. She suddenly felt like a prize that Leora and Ishak were fighting to win, and she didn't like it one bit. Salsana made her way slowly to her feet, grimacing all the while.
You'd rather I left Chayda there?
I'd rather. I was told before you left.
Your mother sends her apologies, but time was of the essence.
Ishak made a non-committal grunt and stared at the rust-stained bandages on her arms.
So you fetched her. Then what? A bloody Irek attacked you?
Salsana remained silent. When Ishak looked to Chayda, though, Salsana finally spoke.
We sparred. I took my eye from her Aesir for a moment and it attacked me.
You're Aesir?
Ishak took Chayda in anew, suddenly viewing her as a threat.
It attacked Salsana?
He, Chayda corrected. His name is Karim, and he attacked Salsana to protect me. A wail sounded in the distance. Karim, hidden among the standing stones.
Be silent, Chayda urged him, and leave at least until this is done.
Karim refused to move away, but thankfully came no closer. Ishak's frown deepened, making him look like a wolverine, and the men behind him bristled. Chayda was just about to reach for River's daughter when Salsana said,
It was my fault.
Ishak's bushy eyebrows rose.
Yours?
Salsana glanced sidelong at Chayda.
We had a minor disagreement. The beast was only trying to protect her.
He is no beast, Chayda said flatly. He is blood of our blood.
Ishak seemed to have trouble grasping those words. He glanced at Salsana's wounds, then regarded Chayda with the same sort of distaste Salsana had shown the day before. Surely he knew the truth, though. Surely he knew the Aesirim's history, perhaps better than Chayda did. But perhaps he believed the Aesirim were forever lost on the night of Bet Iman.
Can you bring it to here?
Ishak asked her.
When needed.
Good.
He drew his shamshir.
Then do so now, and we can be rid of it.
Chayda rocked back in surprise.
I told you, he is blood of our blood. No. Our blood was taken from it long ago. His veins now run with the blood of the kings.
He is loyal to me.
Today, perhaps. But what about tomorrow? What about the day after?
He waved to Salsana.
What about when he feels the need to defend you once again? Who will he attack then? Our elders? Our children?
Before Chayda could speak, he went on.
My heart rejoices that you're safe in our care, Chayda. But I will not allow such a creature near us. As surely as the sun does rise, it will be sniffed out by the kings or the Blade Maidens, and through it, they will discover us.
We've avoided the kings for weeks. Karim is mine, I am his, and I will die to protect him.
Ishak considered this, his face long as if he were saddened by what he was about to do. With a flick of one hand to the men behind him, he said,
Go. Kill it if you can, drive it away if you can't.
Chayda stood regarding them all.
Your face my blade first.
The men pulled the bows from around their shoulders and strung them easily. The one closest to Chayda drew his sword, quite rightly wary of her. Diving and rolling over her blanket, she came up holding River's daughter. The lead man charged toward her. She blocked two blows, then performed a reverse spin, bringing her heel neatly across the back of his head. He fell limp to the sand, but the others were abandoning their bows and drawing their swords, fanning out to flank her.
"Chedamin Ayanashala!"
Ishak roared.
"Stop this madness!"
But she was no child to be cowed by his presence, nor a callow girl impressed by the power he wielded. She was a blade maiden, and that meant much. As the men advanced, Chayda retreated to the nearest of the standing stones. They tried to cut her off, but she used their haste against them. She took the nearest with a flying kick to the face while blocking his slow attempt to cut across her midsection. The next she felled with a sweep of her legs. The other three came at her from the opposite side of the stone, swords blurring. They tried to pen her in, pressing her toward the tall red stone. Chayda blocked a series of blows, then ran up the stone, kicking up and away and flying over their heads. The nearest followed her movements, hoping to take her as she landed, but he was overeager. He brought his sword down like a headsman. It was a simple matter of dodging that downward swing and hammering the crown of his head with the pommel of her shamshir. He fell backward, eyelids fluttering, while Chayda turned and blocked a tentative slash from the other warrior. She lifted her shin to block his kick, then snapped the toe of her boot into his jaw. Spinning the other way, she sent him flying with a back kick to the chest. The men and women of Ishak's ragtag tribe were leaving the business of unloading their ships and skiffs, drawing swords and rushing to aid their fallen brothers. Salsana, closer than the others, limped toward Chayda, sword in hand, but instead of attacking Chayda, she stood beside her, protecting her.
"Leave her alone!" Salsana shouted. "Her and the Aesir!"
Ishak had 20 more warriors behind him, ready to do as he wished.
"I'm sorry, Salsana, I will not!"
A bell rang over the desert. From the east came a ship, a small yacht Chayda recognized from childhood, from the time she had first met Salsana.
Tulathan's bright smile, this was Leora's ship.
As the bell continued to ring, all eyes turned toward it. It sailed in at near full speed, heading straight toward Chayda and Salsana. As the crew, four women wearing wheat-colored dresses, pulled in the sails, an iron grate with hooks was thrown from the back. The hooks bit into the sand and dirt, throwing up furrows as the yacht slowed sharply. As it came to a halt, a gangway was lowered. Along this, an old, heavy-set woman, holding a warped cane, made her way down to the sand. Her simple yellow dress, which flowed easily in the stiff wind, made her look like a flame dancing over the desert. Small grimaces might have accompanied each uneven step, but she held her head high, seeming to will herself forward. A host of memories welled up inside Chayda. This was Leora, the woman Aya had taken Chayda to see so that they might gain her counsel. She was Ishak's mother and Chayda's great-grandmother. Most in the crowd bowed their heads, some did not, however. Among them was Ishak, who seemed both unsurprised and displeased by Leora's sudden arrival. Leora tugged her scarf down, revealing deep crags along the skin of her face. Tattoos of birds taking wing and crescent moons were faded and misshapen with age. But there was what looked to be a fresh tattoo of an acacia, the top of which was inked across her chin, the trunk and roots lost to the sagging skin of her neck. The most striking thing about her, however, was the bright amethyst ring she wore on her right hand, the one that gripped the cane. It sparkled beneath the sun, drawing the eye like a sun dog in the sky.
"What is this?"
she called in a strong, if tremulous, voice.
"Your servant returned with your prize,"
Ishak replied.
"She's brought one of the Asirim, a creature even you will agree must die before the kings are alerted to our presence."
Leora's tongue ran along the inside of her cheek, as if she were trying to dislodge something stringy. She stared at Cheder, as if she wished to peel away her skin and lay her secrets bare.
"Or we might abandon them here, or drive them both away under the threat of death."
Ishak closed his eyes for a moment, as if he recognized the sort of battle that was brewing.
"Is that what you wish? To send them away?" "It is a possibility." "Clearly, that isn't what you wish, so get your point, old woman." "Another possibility," she said as if she hadn't heard her son's words, "is to send the Asir away to live out his life in the desert, or return to the kings as it wishes. Or before doing anything else, we might speak to it and learn what it knows." "The Asir must die,"
Ishak said loudly.
"Cheddar has been in the desert for some time now, weeks. One presumes that the Asir has been with her the entire time. One also presumes that the kings very dearly wish to speak to her. Yet she has not been found. So I wonder what rush there is to kill the Asir, when there might be very much gained by letting it live. Have you not seen what it has done already? Salsana was attacked by that creature, and Cheda was right there."
He turned to Salsana.
"Is it not so?"
But before Salsana could say a word, Leora went on,
"Are we so scared of a little blood that we would kill the innocent? It attacked one of our own. And you ordered your men to attack your own granddaughter, to get at the creature who cowers from you. Look beyond this day, my son."
She spread her arms wide and turned in a circle, taking in all who gathered. She looked triumphant, oblivious to her own infirmity, a goddess in her own right.
"I ask you all to look beyond this day. Our daughter has returned to us, and she has brought one of those who was forced to hunt us for centuries. They have been merciless. They've killed many of our number. But I ask you, whose fault is that? They've been caught in the spell of the gods and given to the kings to do with as they will. But now one comes to us, unshackled, freed. That you could think of spilling its blood without learning more shames me."
She turned her gaze on Ishak.
"Have I not told you? The Night of Endless Swords was a turning point. This is but more evidence. We will not take the life of one who has come to us in need of shelter. One weakened by centuries of enslavement, ground down by 400 years of duty forced on them by the gods themselves. Look what Chedamin Ayanashala has done. Thank her for the gift she has brought before us. For in the hated Asirim, there is knowledge. We must only be brave enough to unlock it.
Ishak looked ready to say more, but the words died on his lips when another of Karim's wails filled the cool morning air. It trailed off into a strange, sorrow-filled barking. Gods, he was crying. Chaida didn't understand why at first, but after a moment she thought she understood. The Asurim were compelled to protect the kings, and here was Ishak Kirhanava, their sworn enemy. There was a powerful urge in him to attack, just as he had Salsana. He wanted to do it. Kill Ishak and Leora and Salsana and more. And yet, he and those gathered were all of the same blood. Karim felt the same sort of loyalty toward Ishak that he did toward his brothers and sisters of the Asurim. The internal struggle was tearing him in two. "Go to the desert," Chaida said to him. "I'll find you when we're preparing to leave." To her surprise, she felt not only assent, but relief. Ishak's will to see Karim dead had ebbed. More importantly, his willingness to hurt Chaida in order to do it had weakened as well, giving Karim the space he needed to obey. As Leora's words faded, all eyes turned to Ishak. If he was embarrassed at his own mother's defense of the Asurim, he didn't show it. He waved to those nearest.
"Go, unload the ships, prepare the tents. We have much to do before others arrive."
Then he turned and walked away, toward the nearest of the ships beyond Leora's yacht. His men followed, leaving Chaida and Salsana alone with Leora. Leora followed Ishak's retreating form.
"Come," she said over her shoulder, "unless you wish to be left in the dark once again."
Chapter 15. Davood stood on the foredeck of a royal yacht, watching the setting sun throw shadows against the dunes. The desert ahead looked like the skin of a slumbering beast, a dragon waiting to rise and consume the world. Bet-Jair, knight of the Asurim, had returned to the desert. Tulathan, a bright silver coin against a sky of autumn leaves, had already risen. Golden Rhea would soon follow. Somewhere ahead of the ship, a long, low moan came. It rose above the rainfall sound of the ship's skis, but then was lost, as if the dunes had swallowed it. Another came a moment later, this one closer, and Davood's skin prickled. Back near the pilot, Sukru's man, Xander, leaned against the gunwales, arms crossed over his broad chest, his long, dark hair tied back into a tail. He looked not merely bored but irritated at having been asked to accompany Sukru on this voyage. Amidships, Sukru himself stood crookedly, watching the way ahead with one hand on the main mast to steady himself. Davood didn't understand how the reaping could commence in Sharakai with Sukru here aboard the ship. Sukru was the reaping king, who was supposed to guide the Asurim to their tributes in the city. But here he was, visiting the blooming fields, while the Asurim stirred and began their night-long journey. Perhaps he had already marked those who would be taken, or maybe he had whispered the names of the chosen to the Asurim on a previous journey. Davood didn't know, and he daren't ask. Sukru made Davood's gut churn just to look at him. It seemed wrong that a man should live so long as the eldest of the kings had. Davood wondered what he would do were he given 4 centuries more, or rather, what those 4 centuries would do to him. Would he turn as sour as Sukru? Would the decades eat at him, rotting his insides until he yearned for the farther fields? What a curse to live so long. And yet, not so long ago,
who'd thought how magnificent it must be to be a king of Sharakai. The foolish thoughts of a boy. The sun's light faded, and the moon's continued their rise. Ahead, the blooming fields were nearer. Pinpoints of light among the greater darkness. Pale blue stars reflected in pools of black ink. But they weren't stars. They were the Adhikara blooms, opening to take in the full light of the twin moons.
"Prepare to anchor!"
the pilot called.
"Preparing to anchor!"
echoed the crew. The ship slowed and eventually came to a rest a short walk from the expanse of stony ground that surrounded the blooming fields. A long gangplank was laid out for Sukru, who took it cautiously down to the sand.
"Come, boy!"
Davood obeyed, and together the two of them approached the nearest cluster of trees. Following them at a respectful distance was Xander, wearing his black leather armor and a silver spear in his white hauberk and chainmail. Shortly before Davood and Sukru reached the edge of the trees, a wailing sound rose up, so close it made the hair along the back of Davood's neck stand up. He halted reflexively, while Sukru took a whip from his belt and sent it cracking over the tops of the nearby trees. It sounded like thunder rolling slowly over the broken landscape. The wailing stopped immediately, replaced by the sound of movement. The Adhikara branches parted, and out loped an angular figure. Dropping to all fours, it galloped north toward Sharakai.
"Come,"
Sukru said, and made for a gap between the trees.
"They're often found within the groves."
They followed a winding path through the trees. The smell here was fragrant and so floral it made Davood's nose itch. At times they passed through archways where the branches reached like grasping hands. When Sukru came nearer, branches shied away like penitent children clearing the way. Davood watched carefully for any stray branches, his whole body curled inward as they moved deeper into the grove.
"There!"
Sukru stopped and motioned to a particularly gnarled mass of thorny branches. At first, Davood had no idea why he'd chosen it, for it seemed no different than the others. But he soon saw that its movements were markedly different. The way its branches swayed made the grove look like an overturned insect, legs wriggling as it neared death. The moonlit blooms, which gave off a faint glow of their own, had a different hue. A pale amaranth purple instead of the washed-out blue of the trees surrounding it. And the smell. The fragrance of the blooms was still present, but so too were the scents of rot and decay. Sukru was bent over, staring intently at the base.
"I found the first of these years ago. I thought it a simple aberration and had it destroyed, but I found another month later. Then more after that. They littered the killing fields. What happened to them?"
Sukru glanced back at him.
"That is what you're here to find out."
He faced Davood. Even by the light of the twin moons, Davood could tell he was being measured.
"What I tell you now is between us."
"Of course, my lord king."
"I believe you are true to the cause of the rightful kings of the great Shangazi. If I did not, I would have ended your life by now. There are few with talent like yours in the House of Kings, and I trust none of them. But Kaelira has judged your soul worthy, as has Xander, and the masters who taught you at the Collegia. And the people of Rose Ridge and the Bizarre, whom we spoke to at length. They've convinced me
that we can work together to solve this riddle.
My Lord King, you honor me. I would be happy to help in any way.
Lend me your ears, not your mouth.
He motioned to the writhing Adhikara.
For generations, the Asirim have protected our city. I won't insult your intelligence by reminding you that every last one embraces their role as protector. But their burden is heavy. And not every man and woman, even with power, bestowed by the gods themselves, can shoulder it. Some bend, others break. So it is that some few have defied the kings. They have fought our will. Some have attacked us, even killed maidens before they were put down. Mezut had been at great pains to learn why. He never did for certain, but now I wonder, might the Asirim have been infected in some way? Might the Adhikara have tainted them? This is, after all, where they lie when not called upon by the kings. I wonder if the earth itself has been poisoned.
Sukru motioned to the writhing trees.
Most are unaware, but the souls who are taken in tribute each night of Bejair are returned here. Their blood sustains the twisted trees, and the trees in turn sustain the Asirim. Blood, boy. It's all to do with blood.
Davud thought a moment.
You're suggesting that the blood of those brought here is tainting the Adhikara?
I've pondered the notion. Perhaps that's why the trees writhe so. Or perhaps the trees themselves have begun to die. Or it might be that some other magic is at work. We must learn more.
As the branches all around them continued to wave softly beneath the moons, Sukru spread his arms as if to encompass the whole of the blooming field.
And so you will bind yourself to the trees. You will learn what you can and share it with me.
Shall we begin now?
Davud asked.
You'll need blood, Sukru said.
Davud paused.
Am I to use your blood?
Sukru's laughter was biting.
You think I would give you my blood? You take me for a fool, Davud Mazunava.
Davud thought of the blood Sukru had taken from him and Anila, stored in vials somewhere for purposes Davud could only guess at.
I'm happy to use mine, though the effects will be diminished.
You'll not take my blood or your own.
He waved to the tree.
We are here tonight, so you can take the blood of the dying as they are fed to the Adhikara.
My king?
He knew exactly what Sukru meant, but the thought of being here when it happened.
The Asir will return within an hour. Best you begin your preparations now.
Of course, my lord king. Dear gods, he was going to force Davud to watch.
He prayed the unfortunate soul who had been marked by Sukru would be dead by the time he arrived, but something told him he wouldn't be. Given the eagerness with which Sukru was watching him, and the trouble he had gone to prepare for this night, Davud was sure the king would require fresh blood. Alive, as the saying went. As Sukru had bade, Davud knelt in the sand. He drew the sigil from memory, not the one the firefinch had drawn with twigs and leaves, but the one Sukru had copied into Davud's book. He did it for Sukru's benefit, but it was also calming. He wanted to focus on something, anything besides the sacrifice that would soon come. When he finished, he wiped it away and began anew, but soon slowed his movements. His stomach had begun burning from the moment he realized what lay ahead, but the feeling of the sand beneath his fingertip reminded him of his childhood, when he would draw pictures in the dunes with his older sister, Taylor. Slowly he was able to push away his fears and stand to face Sukru.
"My Lord King, you needn't take a life," he said confidently. "I can do this with my own blood."
Sukru, stretching one shoulder as if it pained him, sized Davood up as if he had just spat on his food.
"If you suppose that your blood will be equal to a tribute whose blood will mix with the very roots of the Adhikara, then you are a fool. Wait, boy. Be patient. Use the blood I've called here for this purpose."
There was sense in his words, and whoever was brought here would have died anyway.
"Coward, you simply don't wish to bloody your hands."
He tried to tell himself that being chosen was a high honor, but he found reassurance impossible when the wail of an Aesir sounded over the desert. It came again soon after, higher than before, more pained as if it grieved over Sharakai. Davood saw it approaching through the thorny branches. It was heading for a different cluster of Adhikara, but when Sukru's whip cracked overhead, the Aesir changed course and headed straight for them. It trudged along the pathway Sukru had forged earlier, dragging an old man by his ankle. When it came near, Davood stepped back in horror. Sukru, however, merely gestured toward the afflicted Adhikara. Immediately, the Aesir lifted the man as if he were made of cloth and hay and threw him into the tree. The poor soul woke screaming. The branches of the Adhikara wrapped around him and squeezed ever tighter, while the nearby trees moved with the verve and violence of a riot. Thankfully, the man's voice was choked off a moment later as a vine wrapped around his throat. Davood clutched his hands to his own throat. He felt a fool for doing so, a little boy who had lost his mema. But he couldn't help it. He'd stood before the dead, but he had never seen someone die before. And to see it like this, a tree tearing a man apart, made his gut feel like a nest of roiling termites. A long, gurgling rasp escaped the man's throat as he was pulled deeper and deeper into the tree, the branches squeezing until his final breath was pressed from him at last. The blood slicking his clothes and skin was turned silver and black by the light of the twin moons. Only the barest hint of crimson remained.
"It looks like poison," Davood thought. "Poison from the Adhikara, leaking from his skin, as if he too has been tainted."
"Find your nerve, boy," Sukru said. "It's time."
Davood glanced at the king and nodded, yet it took him the span of one deep breath to take a step forward, to kneel, to carefully reach between the quivering branches and touch his finger to the blood that had gathered near the base of the tree.
"Merciful Baki, it's still hot."
Of course it was. The man had just died. But it felt as though he was stealing a part of his soul by doing this. It was a thing that would surely displease Baki, who would even now be leading the man to the farther fields. Earlier, Davood had drawn the sigil Sukru had given him. Wasn't the first rule of creating an illusion to show the audience what you wanted them to see? This time, he drew the firefinch's sigil. He projected self-assurance, as a cheap confidence man would, and kept his hand tilted away, just enough that Sukru wouldn't be able to see the sigil clearly, but not so much that he'd suspect Davood of trying to hide something. As he worked, he built the sigil in his mind
and reached out to the Adhikara, just as he had with the fig tree. Little happened at first, but then, like the coming sun burning brighter along the horizon, a feeling grew within him, a sense that there was more around him than sand and stone and spilling moonlight. Cheda had once told him she could sense the Asiram, and although Davood couldn't feel them, he certainly felt the trees. Collectively, they felt like a vast body of water, with him standing at its very edge. He tried to take a step into it, but could not. It was too strange, too unknowable. When he tried harder, he felt the waters retreating before him.
"No,"
he said, heedless of what King Sukru might think. Yet even though he tried harder, the water still fell, until it seemed as though they were being drawn into the desert and would be forever unreachable. With a calm born of an instinct to learn, a skill he had honed in his years studying in the collegia, he said, "No," once more, and pressed the sigil against the blood-soaked sand. The waters came rushing back. They splashed against him and the tree, rising up along his body. They swallowed him whole. And suddenly, he felt the trees all around him, and this tree especially. He felt the soul within its arms fading, fading, going to grey. He felt the tree's slow death as the desert's dry heat clawed at it. Felt its renewal as more lives were given to it by the Asiram on the night of the twin moons. Soon he realized that the night of Bet Jair was when these visions, memories, if trees could be said to have such, were brightest. While Rhea and Tulathan stared down, he felt the souls being given, sometimes to this very tree, sometimes to others in the grove, sometimes to others in the vast chain of blooming fields that surrounded the city. On and on it went, one holy night after the next, reaching back through time slowly but surely toward Bet Iman. And then he saw a vision so clear it felt like a blow to the head. He stood, staggered back from it like a man struck by the grandeur of the desert for the first time. The very land he stands upon lies bare. He sees sand, a shelf of stone. The stars shine as though the sun has been shattered, a diaspora of broken glass. And in the distance, coming nearer, a figure of palest blue. She comes naked, limed in silver light, her gossamer hair trailing in the wind. Her arms are spread to the heavens, as though beckoning the stars to attend her. And where she treads, green shoots lift from the stone. On she walks, the twisting branches of nascent trees sprouting like a broadening green carpet behind her. She is walking toward Davood. Gone is Sukru. Gone are the Asiram. Gone are the tortured trees. There is only the bright goddess and Davood. Until now she has walked across the landscape as if she were alone. But as she nears Davood, she stops and smiles a leopard's smile, perhaps over some secret she hides, or from simple surprise at finding Davood here. Her nakedness bothers him not at all. It seems only right for the desert is hers to command.
"Why have you done all this?"
When she doesn't answer, he asks,
"What's happened to the Adhikara?"
She seems to stare at him as she passes, but says nothing, making him wonder if she truly saw him. She continues to walk toward the horizon,
her path slowly curving until she is gone, leaving Davood alone with the wind, the gently blowing sand, and the trees that have already grown as high as his knees. When the vision faded, Davood was unsure how much time had passed. One moment he was watching Tulathan's wake, the next he was facing the eastern horizon as the morning sun rose above the Adhikara. The trees themselves were still, their blooms closed. It was so disorienting, he staggered back, then realized his sleeve was caught. Immediately he stopped, remembering he was among killing plants, deadly if their thorns were to pierce his skin. Slowly he pulled the fabric free, making a mental note to burn these clothes on his return to the palace. The Aesir was gone, which was hardly a surprise, but Sukru was gone as well. As he left the grove, he found Xander a short distance away, pissing into the trees. He finished his business, tied his trousers and trudged toward Davood.
I think I saw a goddess.
Davood stopped speaking when Xander raised his hands.
I don't want to hear it. Tell your king.
Davood nodded numbly, and together they headed back toward the yacht. Sukru met them halfway, gliding over the sand with the look of a vulture hopping toward its dying prey. As Xander continued on, Sukru said,
Go on, boy.
Gods, where to begin?
It worked.
Sukru was not amused.
Had it not been for the 5 hours you just spent staring at the same tree, I would never have guessed. Tell me what you've learned.
Davood did, all of it. From the feelings of connection to the receding water, to the sacrifices going back through time. He spent the most time on Tulathan, partially because he had been so transfixed by her, but also because Sukru kept asking for clarification about what she'd said, her description, and her effect on the trees and the surrounding land.
And the tree?
Sukru asked when he was done. Davood shrugged.
I could sense the illness in it, but in truth no more than by merely staring at it or smelling it. Whatever sense of disease there was faded entirely as I was drawn back toward Bet Iman. I learned nothing more.
Sukru considered for a time.
Very well, he said at last,
flicking his fingers for Davood to follow him toward the ship.
We'll try again soon. Until then, I'll provide you with more sigils.
As they walked side by side over the sand, Davood couldn't help but wonder,
if the blood of a tribute achieved this much, what might the blood of the Aesirum give me?
He glanced sidelong at Sukru.
What might the blood of a king?
Chapter 16. Meriem was in her apartments when Ramad returned from the widow's estate, but it took her nearly an hour to finish discussing plans for Basilio's return to Chimere. When Basilio finally left, he strode past Ramad with the look of a sow that had just enjoyed its fill of slop. Ramad would like nothing more than to wipe that smug look off his face, but he was still so angry about Tiron, he held his tongue and walked in through the double doors leading into Meriem's apartments. He closed the doors behind him and found Meriem sitting by the fireplace.
How could you have let Tiron?
He stopped, for Meriem was shaking her head and beckoning him closer. As he stepped near, she bit the inside of her lip and touched her forefinger to it. It came away bloody. She used it to wipe her spit and blood over Ramad's own lips, a precaution so that their words wouldn't carry to the King of Whispers. It may be wise, but the delay made him feel manipulated, and it only made him angrier.
How could you have given Tiron to a woman like the widow?
Don't be such a fool, Ramad. Tiron volunteered.
The words struck like a hammer blow.
Tiron!
Yes, he chose this. He was weakened after the loss of his cousin Lucan and fell to the touch of the smoke. So I summoned him and gave him the choice. I would help him heal, or he could give himself to this mission. He chose the mission. And now we're nearly there. Soon he'll be taken to the Tattered Prince.
The Tattered Prince?
And suddenly Ramad understood all of it. Understood Tiron's being given to the widow, being left there until near death, and what Meriem planned to do with him now.
You're using him as bait.
If Meriem were embarrassed, it didn't show in the skeletal features of her face.
Yes, I am.
The Tattered Prince also called the Torn Man, for the scars that riddled his body, had become something of a legend in the city's West End. His real name was Brahma, and he had a small but loyal group of men and women. It was said he healed those in the grips of the Black Lotus's lure. Some were so thankful, they joined him in what Ramad could only describe as a cult, with Brahma as their enigmatic leader. More importantly for Meriem, Brahma had a gemstone, a massive sapphire that housed, in all likelihood, a powerful demon, an Erek.
We have enough to worry about without calling that sort of trouble down on ourselves. There's always danger, Ramad, when one seeks power. Perhaps, but this sort of power isn't worth the risk.
I disagree. If we succeed in this, it will all have been worth it.
She seemed incredulous at his hesitance.
Can you not feel Guldrathan's impatience? Time is a luxury we can no longer afford.
Guldrathan was the Erek they had bargained with in the desert to free themselves. Ramad had promised neither his own life nor even Meriem's, but Chaders if they failed to deliver Hamzakir. And he had given his own blood to seal the bargain. In the months since, he'd felt the weight of that bargain, not only from the guilt but from the growing compulsion. It had the feel of black magic about it, the same feeling as when the Erek had used its magic to draw symbols around the dead body of King Alduin. At that moment, the urge was directionless, but he knew it would soon become a need to do as the Erek wished.
Of course I can feel it, Ramad said. But there's time yet, which is why we should be spending our efforts searching for Hamzakir.
She flicked one hand, as if chasing a fly away.
Unless you're ready to go to the desert yourself. We're doing all we can.
Then let me go in Tiron's stead. He's been through enough.
Meriem pulled herself taller in her chair.
No, I have other plans for you, and Tiron is in too deep to change plans now.
If you had only told me, I could have helped.
I don't need to explain to you every decision I make, Ramad. I don't think you appreciate how aggressive the kings have become of late. The fewer who know, the smaller the chance the King of Whispers will hear us.
When he continued to stare, she closed her eyes and released a long sigh.
I didn't tell you, because I knew you would act.
She sent a dismissive wave in his general direction.
Like this.
But Tiron...
Tiron is a soldier, and we have only begun taking the steps we need in order to make Chimer safe.
This is all for Chimer, then.
Miriam's face reddened.
And for revenge. Don't tell me you've lost your will to see Masid Ishagava hang. Don't tell me you let Hamzakir walk for his crimes, because I won't have it. They will pay, both of them, before this is done. And in the meantime, everything I do will make Chimer far more powerful than the kings would allow, more than my father ever thought to seize.
Tiron was my man.
Marianne pushed herself off the chair in a rush, her eyes afire. She only came up to his collarbone, but she seemed well larger.
You're setting your feelings above the needs of our nation. There was a time that I admired you for it, especially when you were my sister's husband. But I tell you now, it has become an obstacle. Years passed. You and I would joke. I'll have your head if you don't fetch me tea. I'll have your head if you don't rub my shoulders.
She stepped closer, the fire in her heart reflected in her eyes, making her look crazed.
Hear my words. Those days are gone. I will have that gem. And you will help me get it. Not on your terms, but on mine.
Ramard couldn't deny that Meriem had done much, and he was certain she had Chimer's interests at heart. The only question was whether she placed her own thirst for power above them.
Forgive me, my queen,
he said at last.
I've been too easy with our relationship, treating it as it once was. When I press, it is for Chimer, always.
The stiffness in Meriem's frail body softened, and a hint of relief showed in her eyes.
I don't blame you for it, but there is always more going on than I can share. Question me, but by the gods, heed me when I have spoken.
Of course. What would you have me do?
Brahma must offer to heal Tiron. The trouble is he no longer heals everyone. When the two of us inveigled our way into Tarek's mind, we stumbled across a sapphire. The soul we felt within it, the Erek. Her name is Rumayesh, and she is an almost mythical being among the halls of Golden Hill. She once collected souls as I collect Mireian ivory. She chose her victims for how interesting their lives had been. Lately, Brahma has been choosing to heal those with rather storied pasts, a marked difference from months ago when he would heal nearly anyone, no matter their history. I believe Rumayesh is the reason for his change.
It took Ramard a moment to understand.
You chose Tiron because of what happened to us in Eventide.
The satisfaction in Meriem's sallow eyes gave him his answer.
It's dangerous. There's no telling what Rumayesh or Brahma might do with the information. It could implicate you.
We're beyond danger. We have been for some time.
I need that gem, Ramad. I need it to find and defeat Hamzakir and save us from Guldraven.
Meriem took Ramad's hand and squeezed it, a rare show of emotion.
Make them take notice of Tiron. The story he tells them. We'll do the rest.
Ramard nodded slowly.
I know what to do.
2 days later, shortly after dawn, Ramard found himself in the West End once more. He was waiting in the shadows of the same bridge, studying the widow's bulky estate. This time he knew exactly where Tiron was. Before he had left the embassy house, Miriam had given him some of Tiron's blood mixed in wine. She'd bid him drink half of it, then dripped more into his ears, whispering words to bind him to the earth, to the very world around him, in ways Ramad would never